this either. Before we go into First Chronicles, or as Dave says, First Comicals, but before we go into First Chronicles 13 tonight, which is where we're really going, we want to take just a couple of minutes and say a little bit more about God's preparation of David for leadership. This is what Dave was sort of sharing last week in that class, but there's just a little bit more that we want to bring out that he didn't have a chance to share last week because we ran out of time. And just to mention a couple of things about how long the preparation was and the nature of the preparation, because both those things are relevant and pertinent to our lives as well. So as David mentioned last week, scholars estimate that David was probably 12 to 15 years old at the time that Samuel anointed him as king, which was the first of his three anointings, by the way. That was the first one. Later he was anointed king over Judah, and then the third and final anointing was as king over all of Israel. Okay? So 12 to 15 years old at the time of the first anointing. And then by looking at different verses and subtracting numbers, we find out he was 23 years old when he began his reign over Judah. All right? But this was really not the fulfillment of God's plan for him, because we find in 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 10, that at that time only the house of Judah followed David. So all of the rest of Israel was actually following someone else, not David. And then when he was 30 years old, he finally began his reign over all of Israel. But God still had a work of preparation up until that time that he was doing in David's heart. And he had a work of preparation that he was also doing in the people and orchestrating things and getting things into place. And so David was not really ready to assume that place of leadership that God had for him until he was 30 years old, which means that the Lord took 15 to 18 years to prepare David for that place of leadership that he had for him. And remember that it all began with the prophetic word of Samuel over David as they called him in from the sheepfold. And Samuel said, "This is the one. This is the one that God has and anointed him." Well, then they sent him right back out to the sheepfold for how many more years? And I just want to encourage you today, if you've had a prophetic word, you know, that you've been hanging on to and it just seems like it's never going to be fulfilled. You know, maybe it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But David had to wait 15 to 18 years to see that prophetic word fulfilled in his life. But the whole time, God was doing a work of preparation so that when the time was right in his timing, that word could be fulfilled. Okay, so just an encouragement to you. Even though it seemed like nothing had changed and they sent David right back out to the sheep, and I'm sure that in the days and weeks and months and years later, he thought, man, nothing's changed. But it had. There had been a declaration made in the realm of the Spirit, and something had changed, only he didn't see the manifestation of it in the physical until many, many years later. Okay? So just a little bit of encouragement there. This is important, too. The preparation didn't come in the form of elocution classes, right? Or training in how to be a proper king. Did it? No. The preparation came through the injustice, persecution, and victimization he experienced under King Saul. The preparation came through the injustice, persecution, and victimization that he experienced under King Saul. And God allowed all that to build godly character in David, because that was his main requirement for leadership. That's what he was looking for, was a man after his heart, a man of godly character. And so he was preparing David for ministry the whole time that David was running from Saul and hiding in the caves, as Dave talked about last week. And we didn't, if we read on from where we were last week, we're going to kind of skip this bit. But we find out, as you read on, that David did make some mistakes. He made some covenants and some friendships with the enemy, with the Philistines, that got him into some trouble. And he experienced, as a result, some devastating personal loss. And he also experienced some false accusation and blame from his own guys. And we find, though, that God used all this hardship and loss and hurt to strengthen him and prepare him for the call of God that was on his life. All right? So if you've been going through tough times and persecution and hardship and loss and grief and false accusation and blame and victimization and injustice, guess what? God's probably preparing you for something. All right. But now here's the final comment on this, though. There is a direct correlation between how we respond to the hardship, hurt, pain, injustice, persecution, victimization, etc., 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 and how long it takes for the Lord to prepare us for leadership. Okay? There's a direct correlation between how we respond and how long it takes. So if we're hard nuts to crack, it's going to take longer for God to prepare us for that place of leadership. All right? So there's a lot we could say about that, but we won't. All right, let's go on to part two. We've got to give a little background here, because what we're actually going to talk about today, our theme for the night, is how to go after the presence of God the wrong way. Okay? And so we're going to look at David's mistakes here and see if we can learn something from it so that we don't have to repeat them. That's always wise, isn't it? All right. But before we look at why David was going after the ark and after the presence of God, we have to go back a little bit and look at why he had to do that. All right? Because Dave didn't go through this bit in 2 Samuel. Now, there's a little note there that you all have written in your notes. It says the Ark of the Covenant housed the literal presence of God. And this is important because some texts that you read sort of refer to the Ark as a symbol of the presence of God or a representation of the presence of God. But it wasn't a symbol. God dwelt between the wings of the cherubim over the mercy seat. And that's where he met and spoke with them. And so it was the literal presence of God dwelt in the Ark of the Covenant. And so it wasn't symbolic of the presence of God. It was the presence of God. So wherever the Ark went, the presence of God went. And that's very important. All right. Now, in sort of going back and sort of bringing some background here about why the ark needed to be retrieved, we have to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 4. And we find there that the ark had been captured by the Philistines many, many years earlier, and that God allowed the ark, which was the presence of God, remember, to be stolen by the enemy because of the corruption in the priesthood. And remember, that was at the time that Eli was the head priest and the high priest, and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and there was actually a third son too, but it wasn't mentioned much. Anyway, they were involved in a lot of things that just were not what God would have had them involved in, okay? Everything from immorality to doing things with the sacrifices and just in general, a general irreverence for God and for His holy things. And there's just a whole list of things, you know, that they did that were just all wrong, skewed, total lack of integrity in the priesthood. And Eli was quite a weak authority figure in here, and he just let them do whatever they wanted. And so God's judgment was really on the house of Eli, but all of the nation suffered for it. And so it was because of the corruption in the priesthood that he allowed this judgment to come. But it was for the purpose of shaking the people of Israel out of their lethargy and their idolatry. Okay? There's a passage in Matthew. Can't remember where it is, but it kind of talks about God's judgment being for victory or for restoration. And you see here that even though God brought a judgment and allowed the Ark of the Covenant to be stolen in the very presence of God to be stolen by the enemy, it was for the purpose of restoration, which was fulfilled later in the time of David with the tabernacle of David. Okay? So God had a purpose in it, but at the time that it happened, people were very grieved and just heartsick. And then we find as time went on, they sort of forgot about it. And they went on doing what they were doing with never even a thought that the presence of God wasn't there. They became hardened to the fact that His presence wasn't with them. And kind of fell into, I think, some denial, like, oh, isn't everything wonderful? And God wasn't anywhere near there. But that was later. Anyway, just to make a point here, to relate this to us today, Satan wants to steal the presence of God from the church, because in the presence of God, he is defeated. And without the presence of God, the people of God are defeated. Okay, with the presence of God, Satan is defeated. Without the presence of God, the people of God are defeated. So Satan wants to try to steal God's presence from the church in any way that he can too. And the corruption of the leadership is not the only way that he can steal the presence of God. Okay, that's the way it happened in this particular account in this particular time. But there's lots of other ways that the enemy can kind of come in and begin to work to steal God's presence from our midst. One way is disunity. It's in unity that God commands the blessing, right? So if the enemy can come in and bring division and disharmony and a lack of unity, guess what? There's no blessing, right? So that's just another way. But he does try to steal the presence of God from us as well. All right, then we go on to 1 Samuel chapter 5. And we find out that then when the Philistines stole the ark, they took it to a city called Ashdod. And there were five main Philistine cities, and Ashdod was one of them. And in Ashdod, they took it into the temple of Dagon, and they set it right beside the idol of Dagon. And it was like, you know, they recognized the power of God. They knew that there was the presence of God and the power of God in this ark. That's why they wanted it. And they set it right there beside Dagon because they wanted to worship God along with their other idols. And, you know, there's a mixture in there. Yeah, they see the reality of God and they want to worship Him. But at the same time, they don't want to give up these other things they're worshiping too. And you know, even today, there's quite a number of groups where the same thing is happening. You know, like the Unitarian Universalists and the Baha'is. And a lot of the New Agers will recognize, yeah, there's power in the name of Jesus. But we want to worship all the gods of these other world religions as well. And there's a mixture and a mishmash of different things. Okay? They're not willing to follow the one true God. They just want to add him to the collection. Okay? And that's what the Philistines were doing when they put the ark in the temple of Dagon right next to the idol of Dagon. And what happened, though, just to make a long story short, was they kept coming in and finding the statue of Dagon falling over on his face. And they kept setting him back up on his little pedestal, and then they'd come in the next day, and he's back down on his face. And finally, his head and his hands broke off. There wasn't anything left except just his torso. So they finally recognized that something spiritual was going on here, and it really bothered them. And they were quite worried about it and fearful. And then they began to have this plague sweeping through Ashdod and all the surrounding area. And scholars think it's very likely from the description of the plague that it was bubonic plague, something we've experienced in this country upon a time, right? Which century? 16th? 17th? Something like that. Yeah, 16th century. So bubonic plague was probably around at this time as well. All right. So the people of Ashdod, first, these horrible things keep happening to their god Dagon. And then they're all being killed by this horrible plague. So eventually they decide the answer is get rid of the ark. So they send it to another Philistine city, which was really nice of them. And so they sent it to Gath, where the people there were also struck down with the plague. And then the people of Gath, being very nice as well, passed it on to the city of Ekron, who experienced the same thing. So finally they realize that no matter which Philistine city they send it to, they're going to be killed with this plague and bad things are going to happen. So in 1 Samuel chapter 6, we find that the Philistines have had enough. They consult their priests, who tell them to send it back to Israel with a trespass offering to God of 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats. Now, the reason they picked tumors and rats was because the tumors were appearing on their bodies with the plague, and the rats were carrying the plague. And so they made the trespass offering symbolic of what they were experiencing because they had trespassed upon God's holiness. You know, which is really interesting because they actually had some understanding of God and how he works and what his requirements were in some ways, which is very, very interesting. So anyway, they put all these golden tumors and rats in with the ark and put it all on a cart pulled by a couple of milk cows and sent it straight back to Israel. And so the cows ended up in a place called Beth Shemesh. And the people of Beth Shemesh rejoiced greatly when they saw the ark coming down the road. It's like, yay, here comes the presence of God. Wow, it's back. Look, after all these years. But then 50,000 of them were struck down by the Lord because they had the presumption to actually look into the ark, which was a big no-no. But here's why. All right, to look in the ark, one had to lift the mercy seat out of the way. And one had to remove the covering of the blood, which was on the mercy seat. And inside the ark were the tablets of the law. So in effect, what they did was they looked at the law without God's mercy and without the covering of the atoning blood. And it killed them. Okay? Now, there's a New Testament principle where the Apostle Paul basically says the same thing. He says, the letter kills. The letter, meaning the letter of the law, kills. But the Spirit gives life. All right? So as these men removed the mercy seat and removed the blood and looked upon the law without the mercy and the blood, without the atonement of the blood and without God's mercy, as they looked upon the law, it killed them. Okay. All right. So then they all freaked out, and out of fear they called for the men of Kiriath-Jearim to come and to take the ark. It's like, hey, you guys, we don't want this anymore. You come take it. And so they came and got the ark, and they put it in the home of Abinadab for a minimum of 20 years. We're not really, really sure how long it was there. Okay. There's a couple of verses that say it was there for 20 years, but then when you read more, you find out that that was only during the time of David. And it was actually there for a longer period of time, but nobody's really sure exactly how long. No, it was 20 years during... Oh, no, during David's time. Oh, okay, well, I'm probably getting confused. Anyway, this is letter J. Is that your next one in your notes? Okay, here's the scoop on the time frame. All we can say is that it was 20 years minimum. I think that's the bit that goes in your blank. Because some scholars, nobody's sure exactly how long it was with the Philistines. And nobody's sure exactly how long it was at the house of Abinadab in Kiriath-Jearim. Some say it was 50 years. Some say 70 years. And some say over 100 years. So all we can really say is that it was a long time. Okay? All right, but this is the key thing. During this long time, however long it was, the ark was not in the tabernacle of Moses. Yet, they were going through all the motions and saying and doing all the right little religious things in the tabernacle of Moses, and the presence of God wasn't even there. That's key. Also, we get the impression from 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 3, that during the reign of Saul, no one was really concerned or bothered at all about the fact that they were missing the presence of God. Isn't that sad? I mean, they got so hardened. Their hearts were so hardened that they didn't even miss the presence of God anymore. And I might note that this is a cycle that's repeated itself throughout church history. The Dark Ages, case in point. All right? The corruption within the church got so bad during the Dark Ages that God did the same thing. He removed his presence from the church and allowed the enemy to steal his presence from the church. Now, there were little pockets. There was always a remnant somewhere throughout the history of the Dark Ages during that 1,000-year period. There was always a pocket, a remnant that God had preserved. All right, but by and large, the church during the Dark Ages was as dead and dark as a doornail. You know, I mean, there was no presence of God within the church during that 1,000-year period, with the exception of these little pockets of places and individuals. And so you see that same cycle repeating itself even later throughout history. And that's just one example. All right. Now, we're actually going to go on to 1 Chronicles chapter 13. And just to note that the passages in 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 through 11, parallel these same verses in 1 Chronicles chapter 13. They're two different accounts of the same stuff. Okay? So you can look at it in 2 Samuel 6, or you can look at it in 1 Chronicles 13. Now, today I want to look at 1 Chronicles 13 because I think that account is just a little bit more detailed. And so I'd rather look at that one. But they are chronicling the same events. All right. Now, I didn't leave you any blanks. You can just, maybe for the benefit of the tape, we'll just read through it really quick. Because I was afraid if we'd run out of time. But basically, it's pretty straightforward. Verses 1 through 4, David consulted about the people about going to get the ark, who thought it was a great idea. Verses 5 through 6, David gathered all Israel together to bring up the ark from Kiriath-Jearim. Verses 6 and 7, they brought the ark back on a new cart from the house of Abinadab, with Uzzah and Ahio driving the cart. Verse 8, they moved the ark in a processional with all of Israel worshiping before the Lord with all their might in song and with various instruments. Verse 9 and 10, the oxen stumbled and Uzzah put his hand out to steady the ark, and the Lord struck him down because he touched the ark. Verses 11 and 12, David became angry, upset, fearful, and frustrated as a result of what happened. And verses 13 and 14, the ark was moved to the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months while David could sort out what to do. The house of Obed-Edom was blessed because the presence of God was there. Okay, now, we just ran through that whole chapter in about 2 seconds. But that gives us the background. Now, what we want to do is go back and look at that passage in 1 Chronicles 13 a little more carefully and look at the 5 mistakes that David made in pursuing the presence of God. You have a note in your notes at the top there that's all written out for you. And just to bring out a couple of key things that are in there, the fact that David was a man after God's own heart, according to God. And that was in 1 Samuel 13, 14. And the fact that, this is really for the benefit of the tape because you have it in front of you, but we often say that to mean someone who follows the example of another, you know, that he was a man after his heart, like he was a lot like that person. But I think it can also mean that David was one who went after or sought after or pursued the heart of God as well. He was a man after, who sought after God's heart. And I think that's important to recognize, because as we go on and look at David's mistakes, we do want to recognize that his heart was in the right place, his motives were right, and that he was passionate and wholehearted in his seeking after God, and that was good. That was good. And God used his passion for the presence of God to restore his presence to his people and to usher in a season of restoration and freedom that would foreshadow the dispensation of grace to be brought to all the earth through the coming Messiah. All right? So David had, his heart was right. He had a heart after God. His motives were good. But he made a few mistakes, and that's what we're going to look at today. All right. All of David's mistakes in going to get the ark the first time, does that let you know there's going to be a second time? Right. Okay. That's the next class. All right. All of David's mistakes in going to get the ark the first time can be described in modern terminology. Okay, we could say, first of all, right motive, wrong method. We could say, the end does not justify the means. Or we could say, wisdom is just as important as zeal. All right. And with that third one, you might make a note there about Romans 10:2. Wisdom is just as important as zeal. All right, so David's first mistake was he consulted the people instead of the Lord. His first mistake was he consulted the people instead of the Lord. And we have a couple of verses here in your notes. You see from verse 2 and verse 4 and from 1 Chronicles 15, verse 13, that his focus was on whether the people thought it was a good idea or how the people wanted to do it, more than on seeking God about it. Okay? And there's several accounts leading up to this where we find over and over David inquired of the Lord, should I go up against the Philistines? Should I do this? Lord, should I do that? But when he gets to here, who does he consult with? His captains and the people of Israel, and he doesn't consult with the Lord about it. Okay? So that was mistake number one. Now, his mistake was not in wanting to go after the presence of God. I think that was something that God had put in his heart. That was a passionate desire that God had planted there. But his mistake was looking for the approval and affirmation of the people and consulting them instead of inquiring of the Lord about it. All right. And this opened the door for human wisdom and human effort to saturate the plan to get the ark, resulting in failure and tragedy. All right? Because he sought the approval and the affirmation of the people before he talked to God about it, he opened the door for all this human wisdom and effort to sort of begin to filter into the whole plan to go get the ark. All right? And, of course, it failed. All right. The second mistake he made was they did not sanctify or consecrate themselves in preparation for being in the presence of a holy God. They didn't sanctify or consecrate themselves. Now, God had ordained that those who ministered before him wash themselves and consecrate themselves before coming into his presence. And you've got a whole string of references there from the book of Exodus and Leviticus. And Jesus illustrated the same principle in John chapter 13, verse 8. When he told Peter, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. There's a principle that God established of consecration and cleansing and sanctification before people came into his presence, or as people walked with him. And they didn't bother with this the first time. Now, we'll find out later that they went back and corrected that the second time. But if we're careless and sloppy in our walk with God and we fail to respond when he brings conviction or when he stirs our hearts to a deeper level of consecration to him, then we may similarly experience failure in our efforts to do good things. Okay, so there's an important lesson there for us about carelessness and sloppiness in our walk with the Lord. We need to always be quick to repent, quick to respond to the conviction that he puts on our hearts. Because it's as we come before him and receive the provision that he's made through the blood of his Son, then we're cleansed of all unrighteousness, aren't we? And so that cleansing and that consecration takes place as we respond to him when he brings that conviction on our hearts. So we need to be careful about not falling into that place of carelessness. All right. David's third mistake, they carried the ark on a new cart. That's the third one. They carried the ark on a new cart. Mistake number three. God had ordained that the ark only be carried on the shoulders of the priests. And you have a number of references there from the book of Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then something David said again in the next couple of chapters when they go to get the ark the second time. He makes reference to what God had said in chapter 15. So God had ordained that the ark only be carried on the shoulders of the priests. And here they just totally violate God's order and put it on a new cart. Now remember, the Philistines had sent the ark back on a new cart, which they had broken up and used for firewood for the sacrifice to celebrate the ark's return. This was 1 Samuel chapter 6, verse 14. And I think the Israelites may have figured, well, it worked for the Philistines. You know, we'll just do the same thing without really even thinking about it. But this is an important point. They imitated the ways of the religious world around them instead of doing it God's way. Instead of seeking God and saying, okay, God, how were we meant to do it again? No, you've talked about this before. You know, instead of following God's order, seeking God about it, doing it His way, they just, without even thinking about it, fell right into the religious way of doing things. I think there's a lesson for us there as well. Okay. And again, failure and tragedy were the result. All right. Now, wood always symbolizes humanity in the Bible. Whenever you see wood, it speaks of humanity, our human nature. And the fact that they tried to bring the ark back on a wooden cart speaks of man's vehicle and man's plans and man's method or way of doing things. All right? So instead of doing it God's way, they fall into just doing it the religious way, and it's man's plan and man's way. All right? And the fact that it's a new cart was very important. Because it was new and fresh and exciting, they missed the fact that it wasn't God's plan at all. And it wasn't God's way of doing it. Because it was new and fresh and exciting, it was different. And just because it was different, they thought, oh, you know, they didn't even think about it. It seemed so exciting, so fresh. It had to be God, right? No. And so I think sometimes, you know, we can miss God's way of doing things because we get caught up in something that's new and different and fresh, and we don't realize that it's still man's plan, and it's still man's way of doing things, and it's still not God's way, even though it's new and fresh and exciting. All right? So we need discernment in the body of Christ. Sometimes I think we try to employ these new carts to carry the presence of God, and we're unaware that the new and different is not the same as it being God's plan. So we really, really need discernment so that we don't fall into doing things out of our human reasoning and human effort. All right. The fourth mistake. There was no place prepared for the presence of God. There was no place prepared for the presence of God. And that's mistake number four. And the picture we get in 1 Chronicles chapter 13 is, it's a picture of excitement and zeal, but with not a lot of thoughtfulness and preparation. You know, I can almost see these guys. You know, David comes and says, what do you think about going to get the ark? And all the guys say, oh, great idea. Awesome. And somebody says, well, I'll lead up this. And somebody else says, I'll lead up that. And they're all caught up in the excitement of it. And it's like, yeah, we're going to get the ark. Yeah, let's go. And they all take off to go get the ark. And then they wonder why it all fell apart, because they never put any thought or any preparation into it. All right? So, David hadn't even thought through what they were going to do with the ark when they got it. There's no indication that he had any plan at all of what they were going to do with the presence of God when they had it. All right. Now, the natural thing to do would have been to return it to its former resting place in the tabernacle of Moses. All right, and maybe that's what David was going to do. We don't know. But we do know when they get to, when we get to chapter 15, we do find out that God's plan, that this was not God's plan. Because after David sought the Lord about it, he did something different. Okay, so we know that taking it back to the tabernacle of Moses, where it used to be, was not God's plan. And that would have been the logical thing. So we find out that here the logical thing was not the right thing, which we find out later. All right, and so there's just a couple of questions that I put down there. As we seek the return of God's manifest presence to the church, here's some questions we need to ask ourselves. Do we know what He wants us to do with His presence? Have we prepared a place in our own hearts and in the corporate body for His presence? Have we thrown out the things that are not of Him and made room for Him to dwell in our hearts and in our midst? Have we allowed Him to cleanse and purify us that He might find a holy habitation within us for Himself? That's just some questions maybe we want to ask ourselves as we seek to see His presence, manifest presence, return to the church. All right, mistake number 5. Uzzah was allowed to drive the cart and touch the ark. Uzzah was allowed to drive the cart and touch the ark. That was the 5th mistake. All right, Dave's mentioned this before, that Uzzah means strength. And Ahio, who was the other guy driving the cart, means brotherly. So we have this picture of human strength and human unity driving the new cart, representing man's plan and way of doing things. So any wonder that it failed? With human strength and human unity driving the cart, representing man's plan and way of doing things. All right. Then, boom, the tragedy happens. The oxen stumble, and the ark begins to shake. And Uzzah reaches out to try to steady it and gets zapped. All right. And remember, Uzzah means strength. So when we try to accomplish things in our own strength, it's a very precarious place to be, and stumbling is often the result. This is important, too. This happened at the threshing floor. Some guy's name that I've forgotten. Starts with a C. Chidon. Actually, he had 2 different names that he went by. But anyway, it happened as they got to this threshing floor, some farmer's threshing floor, right, as they're passing through. And the threshing floor was the place where the wheat was separated from the chaff. Now, we all have threshing floor experiences in our lives where God's separating the wheat from the chaff, right? And This is important. It will be a time of stumbling for us if we're operating independently of God. If we're operating by human strength and human effort and driving that cart of man's ways of doing things, when we come to the threshing floor experience in our life, there's going to be a stumbling if we're operating independently of God. Which is why it's so important that we seek God's direction and seek for clarity and understanding for every step that we take. There's so many things that I think we just sort of fall into, responding a certain way or reacting a certain way or doing certain things, because we just don't think about it And it ends up being us in Ohio driving the new cart down the road. And then when we hit the threshing floor experience, we hit the skids, and there's a huge failure, and we are kind of left going, oh, what happened? All right. When Uzzah reached out to try to steady the ark, this was in direct contradiction to God's command that no one touch his holy things. This is in Numbers 4:15. He said that if they did touch his holy things with their hands, they would die. And so even though Uzzah's heart was right, you know, like David, he had a right motive. He was trying to help. He was trying to help God out here by steadying the ark. But it was in disobedience to what God had already spoken. And so he had to suffer the consequences of his disobedience. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, in the parallel account over there, it describes what Uzzah's sin really was. And it calls it, it's a Hebrew word that means irreverence. All right? But it was also disobedience because he did what God had said not to do by touching his holy things. Now here's a question for us. How often have we dared to put our hands on what God was doing, thinking our effort was needed to help God out? That's a sobering question for all of us. All right. So just the final point again, that Uzzah's motive was good and it was honorable. But like David, he didn't handle the situation God's way. And again, failure and tragedy were the result. All right. So just to kind of summarize then, 1 Chronicles chapter 13, we could say that David's motive was pure, but his methodology missed the mark. Okay, his motive was pure, but his methodology missed the mark. We could say that David operated out of more zeal than wisdom in this account. We could summarize by saying that his methods were impure because they incorporated human reasoning, human strength, human effort, and human ways. What he did violated God's due order and the directions that he had previously given for how things were to be done. And the final point of our summary is that failure and tragedy were the result. So, tonight, hopefully, we've learned a little bit from David's mistakes, and we've learned how not to go after the presence of God. And then next week, we'll talk a little bit about what David learned and how we can go after the presence of God. All right.